reciprocity with the land. It is a type of technology to know the way to do that, like to pass on, even through, like, even if it was through an oral tradition, to pass on that information and be aware of, like, the way that our relationship with the land works, I think is sort of like a proto technology. But to scale that up to a global cultural thing, I think it would have to involve the invention of, like, new technologies to keep us within the ecological limits. Mm-hmm. So I think we're not against primitivists. We're sort of the opposite, but we agree with them mm-hmm. about not destroying the planet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So how do you see library socialism intersecting with anti-racist or feminist work as well?
When we did the second episode in the series on the irreducible minimum, I kind of stumbled into a framing for this stuff that I really like, because we were talking about meeting people's needs, and like the irreducible minimum should be that people have their needs met. But like a lot of the time when people think about needs, they start to get like really Scrooge about it, and they're like, oh, they need food and shelter and clothing. And it's like, mm-hmm. if you're talking about need for bare survival, yeah, you're right, we need like a little box, maybe a blanket, a few rags to put on, and some gruel. Like, there you have your basic needs, in quotes, taken care of. But like, we all know that that's not a life worth living, and it's actually not a life where you're getting your needs met, because we have needs that aren't just base survival needs. We have needs for like affection and equality and effectiveness in the world, and respect and dignity. And like a lot of those needs are the needs that have been systematically denied to women and to racial minorities in like patriarchal white supremacist societies. So like, if we want to create a society where people are getting their needs met, and if we understand that like dignity and equality and compassion are human needs, and that we all need to experience these things from others in the environment in order to be psychologically healthy and to have good, fulfilling lives in society, then the project of meeting people's needs like necessarily has to start with addressing people whose needs are being systematically denied to them. So like, to me, being anti-racist or being a feminist is just part of meeting people's needs and starting where the problem's at.
Yeah, I really like that. I mean, you've talked about abolishing prisons or whatnot, so I assume, you know, already getting rid of the prison industrial complex would be a huge move in anti-racist movement.
Absolutely. And we talked about reparations, too, in the meeting people's needs episode, just as like a way of like, there's a lot of needs you could think of it. I mean, it'll meet a lot of people's base needs, because money can buy food, shelter, clothing, education, all those things. But it also meets a need for like forgiveness and recognition of past wrongs mm-hmm. and things like that. Mm-hmm. I haven't thought and talked about reparations a lot, but it did come up in that context as like being a way to hit multiple birds with one stone. I just read vegan podcast. bad metaphor. But like to do two things at once and to meet people's needs in both of those ways.
Yeah, bringing your animal killing metaphors into.
Yeah. So, I wanted to ask a bit about this idea of like transition. If you've given a lot of thought to how do we move forward towards this beautiful vision? Have you thought a lot about kind of this idea of the transition process?
Yes. yeah. So, when it comes to transition from one society to another different type of society that's like really, really different. So if we're assuming that in order to redeem this world, we're going to have to make some really, really deep radical changes at the root. Well, we've been doing a little bit of a historical review of some like historical revolutions. It's one of the things that we've been studying recently to sort of better understand this. of how we might transition and what the record's like. Still very early on in our studying, and I have to admit we didn't start already knowing everything about Revolution.
What?
However, something that we figured out, and this is only, it only takes one good revolutionary study to figure this out, is revolutions themselves, even the most revolutionary of revolutions, doesn't happen as a thunderclap. It doesn't happen in a moment where you're walking down the street and then you hear a little trumpet in the distance and people are like, oh, we got a new government now. And then they all go to the town square and kick the old king and then it's done. It's like it's never worked like that. There's never been a revolution that happens like that. Revolutions, even in the most revolutionary of revolutions, which I don't think is the type of revolution we're going to see in the future, but I'll get into that in a second. Even in the most revolutionary of revolutions, it takes like years and years of tension building and planning and failed attempts and all that sort of stuff. And then when the revolution actually happens, there's usually multiple revolutions that happen. There's a revolution, counter-revolution, counter-counter-revolution. Mm-hmm. And that whole process takes decades. And wherever it ends up, fingers crossed, you keep some of the good parts. Even revolution itself doesn't happen as a thunderclap. And I think a lot of people sort of talk about politics that way, like, oh, you can't. And there's this sort of reform versus revolution thing. And it's sort of a critique of social democratic systems under capitalism. I think there's some validity to that critique. But the implicit side of this angle is that there's only two options. There's either these very like sort of tepid reforms, the types of reforms that we associate with literal public liars, politicians who are famous for their enormous lies, on one hand, that you have to go trust these liars, or you have to wait for this magical moment where everything changes. Mm. And that that choice is dumb. It doesn't make sense. That choice isn't wise. That choice is unwise to reduce it to that. I think the process towards revolutionary library socialism, which involves a fundamental challenge to the institution of private property and the way that we view private property, it's a very sort of fundamental challenge, I think, very radical and hard to achieve. Mm-hmm. It takes a few different pieces. And actually, I think there's really only three main pieces that I've identified that will be needed or that actually happen in practice. But there's the narrative realm. There's talking about the issues, having conversations like this, theorizing, theory building, propagandizing, having conversations with people, organizing conversations, moving people to action through a persuasive conversation is also part of that. Mm-hmm. There's also the sort of prefiguration or the creation of institutions, the creations of organizations that do things that need to be done, and whether that's to amplify the spread of information or to provide for people's basic needs not being met by the system. That's the second pillar. And the third pillar is I hate to use the word entryism. I just find it hard to pin down what I'm talking about in a single word. It's any time that you're using the resources of existing institutions, existing bodies of resources, and recognizing where the resources are, getting a hold of them, and then using them to bring about political change, either through something like you could have a state body take on providing for people in need on an ongoing basis. Like that could be the outcome, one of the revolutionary steps within something. Mm-hmm. Or it could be like liquidating the assets of an organization and then putting that all towards training people to have skills and something or whatever. Like these three things interact in all these sort of interesting ways. So like that's the territory, the landscape that the revolution will take place on, the inevitable glorious revolution towards library socialism, which we're all counting on. Mm-hmm. that's the sort of landscape. And from that landscape, we can pull together some like interesting combinations of like, well, these resources came from here. We use it to build X institution and we spread this idea about it, which helped it grow in membership. But the exact form that the transition takes from this society to the next, if I'm forced to make a prediction, I'll say it's going to be really unpredictable. It's not going to look like anything we've done before. Mm-hmm. But it's going to involve this territory. That's my thought on it. And also, I just want to say we can do this sweetie pie. Said this before. We can do this sweetie pie. We can do this without being overly and unnecessarily antagonistic. Not that antagonism isn't going to be part of this process in some cases. But we can do it very straight up and be like, these are our ideas. They are good. I'm going to organize against the bad ideas and just all above board. This is what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I think 99% of the time you can pull off quite a bit with being Sweetie Pie above board and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. You don't need the cloak and dagger stuff. Yeah. Or like the weirdly antagonistic violent stuff.
Totally. Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, no, I completely agree with that as well, that I think the revolution is going to be fairly piecemeal. It's going to be a lot of different people doing a lot of different things. And, you know, the ecological crisis is going to, you know, drive a lot of change very quickly, I think, as well. And yeah, I like thinking about that kind of, you know, three-pronged approach, and also the idea that it takes time and it's not just a thunderclap. Like private property, you know, private property first came into being, I guess, like, you know, shortly after the Neolithic revolution, where people were moving into towns and living that way. And that was kind of, you know, the dawn of private property was kind of the dawn of also patriarchy and all of this other horrible stuff that has plagued us for centuries. And if you think about how long it's been, and, you know, all of that time we've been chipping away at patriarchy, we've been, we haven't really been chipping that much away of private property, but I think that the time that we're in right now is really interesting in that, I don't know, I mean, to have the United States talking more openly about social democracy or like democratic socialism, just the idea that more people kind of in the mainstream can also kind of maybe question this idea of private property, I think it's huge, like given how much time we've been living under the regimes of private property, and as limited as social democracy is, at least it's attempting to, you know, redistribute the wealth, you know, spread the wealth and make sure that people's needs are taken care of. Like, of course, it's not going to solve the contradictions of capitalism, but at least there's a lot of people now who are thinking in that sense that we actually do want to meet people's needs. And the point of an economy is to meet people's needs, not to just to meet the bottom line of the CEOs of Wall Street or whatever. So I'm in full agreement with you. I think also in the West, or just basically like Canada, US, some European countries, the idea of having a thunderclap revolution is pretty unlikely. I feel like we're definitely up against the CIA basically and the military, which are, you know, hard nuts to crack. But I think that putting every foot forward that we can right now is important. And I don't think that we should be poo-pooing anyone's strategy unless it's like they're just overtly being destructive and harming the movement. But like, otherwise, I think that all of this kind of strange division and strange sectarianism that's going on right now, I think is kind of pointless. And I think what were the three pillars again? It was
narrative work, prefiguration, and entry and appropriation.
Right. Yeah, I think the prefiguration piece is really important as well.
I'm really glad you brought up the Neolithic revolution before, because it's something I was thinking about recently, about the way that, I mean, at least the common historical theory goes is that through the Neolithic revolution and the existence of the original existence of surplus, like surplus from farming, became this sort of like thing that generated hierarchy, patriarchy, mm-hmm. capitalism, and so on, mm-hmm. As this like very material historical event. It just brings to mind the possibility that, and I'm not saying this to be hopeless or like deterministic, but it brings forward the possibility that it might take some material structural changes in the world to create the preconditions for a lasting, like, sort of global socialist revolution. And that doesn't mean that we should just wait for that to happen or something. But the possibility is also that we're in that period and it's already underway, and that through mm-hmm. digital technology and replication, the future of, say, like people talking about 3D printers, and there's just a variety of different technological capacities and possibilities that could create a situation where we have a new material base from which to create a social revolution that has a lasting effect on society. I just wanted to draw that parallel between the potential future revolution and the Neolithic revolution, because I think the big revolution, you know, the revolution at the end of history that solves all the problems, being sarcastic by saying that, but the big step forward that we'd actually really like to see might be connected to a technological material. It might look more like the Neolithic revolution than the French revolution. That's what I'm saying. It might. I don't know.
You're saying if we have an abundance, like an abundance of resources again, I mean, we already do have that. Are you saying the opposite, that if resources become more scarce and, like, you know, the ecology starts to fail, then that will create the conditions for socialism?
Yeah, I was thinking of a new type of abundance. Like, we've already got new types of abundances happening all the time, but there might be, like, maybe say a new plateau where there's all these different types of new abundance that create this condition that helps allow for, and we look back in retrospect and we're like, oh yeah, that revolution happened in part because 10 years before everyone got everything they needed in this specific way.
Yeah. One way I think about this is the conversation that's going on in the United States a bit around Andrew Yang's campaign and the universal basic income stuff. And like, we already have enough of everything to provide enough for everyone. We have that abundance, but there is another level, like Sean's saying, there's like a hyper abundance, potential in automation technology. And as more and more things in the economy that currently exist in capitalism are becoming automated, it is throwing a wrench in the traditional capitalist structure of wage earners and employers. And then the wage earners buy the things that feed the companies that keep everything going. So if you have all this automation and you have less and less need for wage earners, then you don't have people who have enough money to buy the things. And so the kind of capitalism patch to that, the way that Andrew Yang and other people want to patch capitalism, is saying, let's give everyone a universal basic income. And like, I think that's a pretty good idea. I think Andrew Yang's version of it isn't great, and there's some good criticisms of it. But like, that dynamic that's at play, the thing that he's talking about, is an example of material conditions forcing a change on the economic system. And like, that is happening right now. And like, we do have a say in how that change happens, each of us, like, no matter how small it is, and it's better when we're together. But like, yeah, the material conditions are forcing a type of change around this right now. And so there's an opportunity there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. You're completely right. And that's only going to get more and more, that contradiction is only going to get more and more acute as we go forward, as well as the ecological contradictions, which are also radicalizing a lot of people. And so, yeah, I agree completely that in a lot of ways, the material conditions will force that change. But also, yes, we have to be there with our utopian dreams for the future so that we can we know which direction we want to walk in when all of this kind of comes to a head.
Yeah. And I don't mean to say that's necessarily going to happen, or like, yeah, that it's going to go one way or the other. It might go the opposite way. We might have less abundance than we've ever had in our lives. And we look back and we're like, oh, the first half of our lives, we had everything we wanted. And now we live in hell. Now we thought Twitter was hell.
Yeah.
Eco-fascism is here.
Yeah, eco-fascism here. We're like, oh man, I thought those Twitter hot takes were really unbearable, but this catastrophic climate change is far worse. Maybe that's the way history goes, and maybe through that we are able to stitch something together to mount a resistance. I don't know. I'm just, I'm floating it as a possibility because I think it's interesting, and I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. So the last question I wanted to ask was about patriarchy and kind of toxic masculinity. We've talked a lot about that on our show and talked about how actually capitalism is the logical extension of thousands of years of patriarchal dominant competitive modes of governance. So, and we've also talked about this idea of, you know, capital R revolution as having some fairly masculinist framings of social change. And so we're wondering, what place do you see for conventional framings of masculinity in this kind of new utopian world? And how do we build better masculinities and kind of ensure that we aren't replicating patriarchal modes of thought or governance going forward?
I mean, one thing that I'll say on the capital R revolution masculinity connection, or like toxic masculinity connection, is that when I was in the process of becoming more radicalized towards left-wing points of view, it was really, really noticeable to me that in discussions where I was trying to reason out loud with people, like have a discourse, and particularly in most cases men, around socialism, around the history of revolution, there was this undercurrent where I felt like I was being called effeminate for saying like, obviously violence is the last resort, right? Like maybe not the last resort, but not the first resort. I mean,
it's
like
at least plan D. If there's plan A, B, and C first, like
yeah.
Plan D, maybe, yeah. But I mean, plan A is like go for it, like try to get everyone on board and like try to, and it, like there's reasons why people are critical of that sort of stuff. But my experience of it was just like these guys are implying that I'm womanlike because I don't want to kill a bunch of people immediately. And like, so I had that experience of like being faced with that sort of like toxic masculinist revolutionary misogyny directed at me, saying that I had failed manhood and I was like a woman with as a result of not wanting to do what they want to do. And that always stuck with me and left like a really bad taste in my mouth around the idea of revolution. So I think here, like, I agree very deeply that this capital R revolution stuff veers into this sort of garbage.
I really like trying to think through these things in ways that aren't so class-centered. Like the idea that the primary othering is actually patriarchy, I think is a really like beneficial lens of analysis. And I think we can look at these things in a lot of different ways, but I think it hurts our thinking when people really want to insist that like, no, we just have to focus on ending capitalism and then like all these other things will fall into place. And it doesn't seem like that's true. And it doesn't seem like that makes sense historically, because capitalism is probably more recent than patriarchy. Like Bookchin likes to premise the origins of this kind of hierarchy and domination in the domination of the old over the young. And I don't know too much about that idea. I know it's in there and it's a brain tickler. I don't think I agree with it, but it's interesting.
Yeah, he talks about that in The Ecology of Freedom a bit, gerontocracy as a potential origin of hierarchy. But I'm in the same position as you, Aaron, where I'm like, I don't think that's necessarily true, but I like the possibilities it opens up and like thinking about different ways of like what could be sort of the keystone.
Yeah, and it also like places the thing we need to change, not just at, you know, we have to storm the state house and take over the machine and start running it in favor of the proletariat, and then everything else will fall into place like that again. Like the idea that we have to like address patriarchy, racism, homophobia, transphobia, gerontocracy to the extent that that's an issue, but just like these feelings of superiority and domination over one another, this ideology that there are some people who are more human, more deserving, more higher up on the hierarchy than others. I think that takes also a lot of internal work and changing how you think about the world and how you relate to the world. And that's also really, really important as an addition to changing the material conditions and changing property relations, which like absolutely 100% on board with, but I just don't think that it will necessarily lead to the end of all domination to do that.
And on framings of masculinity and healthy masculinities, it's a territory that like my instinct is to want to stuff that's classified as like masculine and feminine. There's some arbitrariness to it. And there's these things that, like, for example, when you think of nourishing in the masculine sense and nourishing in the feminine sense, but there's this underlying in people's performance of gender. So this is sort of an unfinished idea, but in people's ideas of gender, there's this underlying sort of like nourishing thing that fits different frames, different cultural frames of how our gender is supposed to nourish one another. And I think just like, I want to democratize masculinity in a sense. I want to like the good side of masculinity, or like the positive, whatever version of non-toxic masculinity exists, and non-toxic femininity. I want to democratize these things in their cultural validity. I want to be able to take what's liberatory about these ideas and distribute them freely and make them make gender a playground and not a prison, a buffet, all you can eat gender, anything good you want. But the thing about gender roles and stuff in society is that to be human is to nourish. And I think that's the bottom. And I don't mean to say this to brush aside difference or like be like, oh, it's not feminism, it's humanism or something like that. But underlying it all, there's this nourishment, like humans are to nourish. And we gender that in different weird ways, but humans nourish. And I think that's a really wonderful thing. And that's what I think of when I think of healthy masculinity, but also healthy non-masculinity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because nourishing in our patriarchal society, like nourishing in the sense of, you know, emotional, supportive nourishing is coded as feminine. And then everything that's coded as feminine is considered less than or embarrassing or, something that's not to be respected. So, I think kind of democratizing that, or potentially thinking about masculinity in which people feel comfortable. People are made to feel comfortable in society for kind of buffet selecting different things that were at one point coded as feminine and therefore shameful or undesirable. I think that's definitely important.
And a way that nourishing takes a role within masculinity is this idea of like protection, but then also at the same time, like,
and providing.
Providing is sort of nourishing. There's also a protection angle, but then also mothers protect their young, but we're not mm-hmm. like, oh, that mother's so masculine mm-hmm. in providing and protecting her kid. Like yeah. there's, mm-hmm. it's the whole, I get, you know, when people are like, this stuff's actually weird. I agree with them. It's all sort of weird.
Yeah. It is very weird. And I like, Aaron, what you were saying about how, if we keep our framing, if we only see the division between people as the division between classes, and we don't see other forms of othering as really, really central, then the approach that we take to fighting this is going to be, okay, well, there's the bad guys. Let's get a bunch of people and go get them. And then we'll create a better society. And people don't think about what they have to do within themselves, right? Like, people don't think about, we can't really build a better world if we're all othering other people. Like, capitalism wouldn't exist without othering and this idea of dominance and things like that. So we have to actually look inside of ourselves and say, like, what is it that makes me other another person? And I get kind of deep with this and say, like, well, it's ego. And so we have to actually, like, all be addressing our egos if we're going to come together and build something better. But then people will be like, oh, that's new agey bullshit and whatnot. But I think it's really important.
Yeah, no, it is. It's just part of psychology that people have egos, and like, our egos protect us from like our emotional damage and our emotional issues. And they like tell us we're great and that we're better than other people. Like, that's what it does. Like, it's a part of people's minds. We know that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, like I think addressing egos means like you got to do some like emotional archaeology, like Mr. Rogers likes to talk about, get to the roots of these feelings that you have that you might not know exactly how to deal with. Mm-hmm. And then you will start to have a more functional relationship with the world, because your ego can calm down a bit. It doesn't need to protect you as much anymore, because you are a bit more at peace with yourself and with what's going on inside you.
Yeah. How sick is that, that talking about your feelings isn't cool?
Yeah.
Right. You know? Well, it's a patriarchy thing. It's coded as feminine and it's like frivolous.
So, mm-hmm. I mean, it just goes to show yet again, coolness is on the wrong side of history.
100%.
The revolution will not be cool.
It will be not cool at all. It'll be so lame. But yeah, no, and I think that's a really great way to understand why a lot of these, you know, capital R revolution, like revenge fantasy, like violent moment of destruction of the other fantasy, as people's first resort, or as people, as what people want, not even like, oh, this is a resort. This is like, I actually want this. I want this revenge. I want to destroy these people. I think it makes sense when you take all of this into consideration, because like under patriarchy, like, you know, men can't talk about their feelings, and the only acceptable emotion for men to really display is often anger, or, you know, the only appropriate response to being harmed or being humiliated or being oppressed is to just destroy the other person, right? So, and that's how you reclaim your manhood and your manpower and your pride and whatever. So I think these are things we have to address as well, because you talk a lot about, you know, the importance of means and ends and how to avoid actually becoming the oppressor. And it's, people think that there's no way that they could kind of replicate oppressive tendencies if they're on the good side, right? Like if they have noble intentions and they're fighting for the good of all, they really think that there's no way that they could replicate a lot of the violent shit that we have now. But I think it's all too easy. And I think that our patriarchal system plays a big role in that. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Like the desire to lash out and get violent is like totally, on the one hand, understandable because of what a like kind of horrifying hell world we live in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And you want to find out who's responsible and hurt them. Like, I think mm-hmm. humans have that impulse a lot, and men especially are encouraged to wallow in that, I guess, for lack of a better term. But I think it like it's important both to like not think of yourself as evil if you get mad and like want to hurt people, because that's something that's a natural human response, but also to want to contextualize that in like do a bigger picture of what's going on both in the world and inside you again, and like, why is this one particular emotional response to something horrifying the primary one that you always want to go to when you're thinking about the horrors of the world? Is there some other emotional responses you're having that you're avoiding? Like anger is usually covering up for other emotions that you don't want to deal with or think about. And I think like, yeah, doing that self-work is going to be a big part in like not becoming the oppressor in like whatever happens, because our plans for the future aren't going to go exactly as we planned. They never could. We're going to have to make stuff up on the fly forever, for like forever. It's really important not just to have a good plan and a good place that you want to go to, but to be coming from a solid place within yourself, approaching all this stuff, so that when you're making stuff up on the fly, you don't veer too far off in a direction that you would have thought impossible at the start of the journey, kind mm-hmm. of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Like whenever I talk about this, I feel like people probably think that I never like get mad or angry, or that like I don't feel super pissed and like want to see these CEOs go down and like all this stuff. Like, of course, I feel like that all the time. But I also want to make sure that like as I approach these projects for the future, like I want to be coming from a place of I'm angry because people are being harmed and they're not getting what they need. And my main goal is one of, you know, love and compassion and making sure that they all get what they need. That's my main drive. Right. And so if someone is going to stand in the way of me helping people to get fed and whatever, and try to attack me or attack those people, then like, yeah, I probably will have to engage in some like violence or conflict, but that's not where I'm coming from initially. Like I'm not someone who just wants to do harm. I'm someone who wants to help. And if people will try to stop that and harm people, then like that's another question. But I think people need to think more about like where they're really coming from.
Yeah.
And I think but not having a sense of outrage at injustice, I think, is unhealthy. Mm-hmm. Like if you don't feel upset when you see wrong being done, and like maybe that veers into the idea of like, I hate that guy, I want to punch him in the face. Maybe it doesn't. But if you don't have a sense of outrage at injustice, like that's an antisocial position to be in. There's like, it's so healthy to see injustice and be like, I know which side I'm on and I really don't like that guy or whatever. And maybe you want to punch him in the face. But we all like, I think a lot more people want to punch people in the face than actually do. And that's a good thing. And if you find yourself in the position that you're constantly wanting to punch everyone in the face, then like Aaron said, maybe the face punching is starting with you. Like maybe the face punching is coming from your end. Maybe. And like, it's not that everyone really deserves it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, important side notes on the,
maybe they deserve it, but like punching them won't actually like help them to be a better person or to whatever, you know?
That's a dangerous, that is a really important point. I'm really glad you said that. There's a lot of people who deserve it, but the rest of us don't deserve them getting it.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's a really important point. I feel like that's a probably good point to leave off on. Is there anything else you'd like to add to the conversation before we wrap up?
No, I just want to thank you for having us on and talking about this stuff, because this was a really, really great conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And it was, I'm really glad that you're doing what you're doing. And also the questions that you brought, it was very stimulating to look at library socialism through these lenses. I appreciate the opportunity.
Like, these are great questions.
I was actually trying to write an article on library socialism for my own like writing practice.
Yes.
And I was like looking at the blank page, and I then went over to the other tab and started thinking about these questions, and it was such a good prompt. It was like, this got me thinking about library socialism so much. So I really, really appreciate the opportunity to talk about it and to and thank you for supporting library socialism.
Oh,
it's
my gosh.
Really, really vindicating. Like, I really care about this stuff, and to have you pick up on it, it's like meaningful to us. So,
y'all, I'm like your number one supporter. As soon as I found your podcast, it was just like, wow, these people are talking about everything that I care about, everything that I've been thinking about. And for me, it really was important. Like, this might sound weird, but it's really important for me to hear like two men talking about this, because I get a lot of flack in leftist spaces for kind of bringing these things up, and people kind of writing it off or make it seem just like effeminate and pointless. And I was like, yes, this is so amazing. So just thank you so much for what you guys are doing, and look forward to all your future podcasts. And thanks so much for coming on the show. This is great.
Thank you. Usually I actually feel bad that we're men. So that's awesome to hear.
Oh no, I'm so thrilled that you are. I'm just like, yes, I love that men are saying this. It's so important that men are saying this. All right. Thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Airing on Asheville FM 103.3 LPFM in Asheville, this is The Final Straw Radio, a weekly anarchist and anti-authoritarian broadcast and podcast emanating out of occupied Chalagee land in southern Appalachia. We bring you voices and perspectives from projects and struggles all around the world, and you can find our archives, transcripts, ways to follow us and support us at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. This week, we're sharing two segments on the show. First up is a conversation with two activists of Appalachians Against Uranium in eastern Tennessee about the expansion of a nuclear weapons development plant in Jonesboro in the Tri-Cities area near the border with North Carolina, Kentucky, and Virginia in the Blue Ridge Mountains. For the interview, we speak about the legacy of the nuclear industry in the region, health impacts on locals, some of the companies like BWXT that are involved, concerns of pollution, and building off the work of past and ongoing civic activism in the region. Find our guests online at their website or at their Blue Sky, which are linked in our show notes. If you missed our prior interview talking about related and other elements of the nuclear industries in the U.S., you can check out our July 19th episode interviewing M.V. Ramana found at our website. After this, you'll hear a recording from May 14th, 2026 of journalist Roser Gari Perez speaking in Freiburg, Germany about the case of the Ulm Five, five activists from various countries held in pretrial detention since September of 2025 in Germany on charges of taking action against an Elbit Systems Deutschland factory in that country. Elbit Systems is an Israeli arms manufacturer whose products bring death to people in Palestine. The defendants have experienced long-term isolation, extraordinarily long pretrial detention without the option of bail, and other weirdness during their hearings. As a note for U.S. listeners, the use of the term protocol in this segment can be translated as meaning taken notes. To take protocol is to take notes. You can keep up on this case and find out how to write letters or send support at ulm5.info. And you can find updated writings on this case on the Instagram or the Left Berlin author page for that journalist I named earlier, Roser Gari Perez. These are also linked in the show notes, alongside of some other resources concerning the topics of today's episode. I hope you enjoy. Want to share just one brief announcement. We received correspondence from Khalif Miller, who was arrested in Philadelphia in 2020 during the George Floyd uprising. According to his GoFundMe, Khalif was held on pretrial detention for 2 years and eventually sentenced to 5 years in federal prison. As he was on probation at the time of his indictment, he was additionally given a 1 to 10 year state sentence for probation violation. He's currently serving that, having been moved out of federal. According to his page on uprisingsupport.org, Khalif has this to say, quote, "I was working. I was trying to get my business up and running. I was going to school. I was doing things not just to help my family. I was trying to help communities. The day that I went to that protest, the night before when I was even making my signs, I spent 4 hours just making signs and writing down a bunch of people who were unfairly killed by police officers. This is something I really feel passionate about. People say all the time, you can do anything you want in America. You can be whatever you want to be. Growing up, I heard it, but I never really believed it because I feel like my resources were limited. The world has so many possibilities. I would like to teach that. That's one of the things I would like to pass on to the younger generations when I come home." So you can check our show notes for links on how you can write to Khalif and ways that you can support him or send him books. Thanks.
I'm Camille. I use she, her pronouns.
Hi, I'm Sam. No pronouns.
And I am a concerned individual and do some organizing with AAU, Appalachians Against Uranium, mostly centered around Johnson City.
Great. Can you say a bit about AAU? You know, does it have a long track record, or is it kind of an informal grouping? And I'm sure a lot of it's in the name, but what is the purpose of the group? What do you do?
Yeah, of course. Appalachians Against Uranium is a fledgling, fairly new group. There's been some other kinds of resistance against militarized nuclear projects in the area, but mostly focused on watchdogging and county commission zoning procedures and government bureaucratic processes. And we wanted a grassroots, fairly public-facing organization that could do other kinds of organizing that's more direct and less mediated through government institutions.
Cool. So, yeah, let's talk about what AAU is worried about. Can you talk a bit about what is going on in Jonesboro and what organizations or companies are engaged around it?
Yeah, absolutely. So in Jonesboro, there's a long-standing munitions plant that has been making depleted uranium munitions, largely anti-tank munitions, for, as I understand it, decades. But this facility was recently bought by BWXT, that's Babcock & Wilcox Technologies, who have an expansion where they just started earth moving about a month ago. And that expansion is geared towards producing what they call high purity depleted uranium, which is a nuclear warhead component. But then they also have a facility in Irwin, Tennessee, which is just 30 minutes away from Jonesboro between Johnson City and Asheville. And that is where the National Fuel Service is located, which has historically been making two things. One is naval propulsion fuel, so nuclear fuel for naval reactors in aircraft carriers and submarines. And then also what they call downblending, which is taking high purity uranium and turning it into low enrichment uranium for civil power generation. And they also have an expansion slated to begin doing high enrichment uranium purification, which would be the only place in the U.S. doing that if they got it off the ground.
Okay, so there's a few things going on there, and this conversation is going to sit after the conversation with Ramana, which covered a lot of, but so this is an instance where we're talking about a specific corporation, BWXT, which has its hands in civilian power related nuclear energy, as well as the military industrial complex elements of it. And we've talked about warheads, and we've also talked about depleted uranium, which we were talking about with Ramana in terms of being anti-tank munitions that are not considered nuclear weapons in the same way as a warhead is. So that's interesting. And so there is pre-existing infrastructure, you were saying, in Irwin. And this is an expansion of a pre-existing depleted uranium plant that's in Jonesboro. Can you talk a bit about some of the history of this region's relationship with nuclear power, and whether it be so-called atoms for peace or so-called atoms for war?
Going back to the Manhattan Project and the initial construction of nuclear weapons and nuclear power in the U.S., Oak Ridge, the so-called secret city just outside of Knoxville, was one of the epicenters of that. And they focused on the uranium enrichment piece of that project, which is just about an hour and a half, 2 hours down the road. And a lot of why it seems like these projects are being located here is because of that proximity. They are making high purity depleted uranium to send to Y-12, which is the national security complex in Oak Ridge that stores enriched uranium and is involved in warhead construction. And so they make the high purity depleted uranium and ship it to Oak Ridge, where it can then get assembled or sent to other government facilities. And on the other side of this, you have the TVA, which operates a variety of nuclear power plants. And they are the only nuclear power plants that are producing plutonium and tritium, which are byproducts of power generation that then get used in nuclear weapons. And it's significant that if you're doing power generation that's producing those byproducts, you need what they call unobligated uranium, because lots of uranium, depending on how you source it, if you import it internationally especially, will have restrictions that it can't get used for weapons manufacturing. And BWXT is notable because they produce unobligated uranium. And so producing the uranium, being proximate to TVA power plants that produce tritium and plutonium, at least tritium, I'm less sure about the plutonium, but TVA power plants that produce nuclear weapons byproducts, and then that is proximate to Y-12, where these items can be stored and potentially assembled, creates this whole ecosystem of nuclear weapons and militarized nuclear technology.
Great. And so Y-12 is the managed project. It's privately managed by a contracted company relating to national security that's in the Oak Ridge area, right? You've mentioned the TVA. So my familiarity with the Tennessee Valley Authority is in relation to the industrialization and electrification of parts of the South and Tennessee, in particular the Roosevelt era, large, massive national and industrial projects throughout the country that got federal funding to do it. In this case, if anyone's seen O Brother, Where Art Thou, there's a valley that's flooded in order to make a large hydroelectric dam there. And so that this is like, I think that it's interesting, the legacy of this quote-unquote public utility that has a private-public partnership that has a deep effect on the communities in which it's based. Can you talk a little bit? I don't know if there's anything there that you want to talk about, or maybe about, like, why is all of this nuclear infrastructure being put at a high elevation in the middle and eastern part of the country in Appalachia, what that says about the surrounding communities and the view that the government has about the quality or the worth of those communities?
Yeah, definitely. Like, my first thought with TVA historically has also been growing up near TVA dams and having hydroelectric generation and then these recreational dams, and this idea that it's about, in some way, flood control. But you start looking into the history, and ultimately this was intentionally flooding some communities in order to produce electricity and mitigate flooding in other communities. And then by controlling the dam, even in real time, having the ability to control how much water you let through and how much you keep back to affect which areas experience flooding and which ones don't, which of course is wrapped up in classism and environmental racism, and just being able to like concentrate and displace these kinds of effects onto less powerful, less desirable communities. And then the TVA getting into nuclear power is like, in part, once you're doing power generation, some companies like expanding into different forms. But I do think the nature of TVA as this weird public utility, private hybrid, set it up to be more likely than most random private utility companies to be producing tritium and nuclear weapons components in that way.
Something that I would like to add on to that, the relationship that these companies have to this area and to the people here. When I was learning more about this issue and learning about politics of uranium generally, I was introduced to the concept of economic hostages through the writing of Scott Perez, who wrote some articles for Dine Care. And yeah, it feels very prescient here that these companies are really promising economic development. They're promising high quality jobs. There's this idea that they're going to be able to come in here and poison the water and poison the air, which we'll get into, and that people will put up with it in the name of economic development.
How does this new expansion relate to the existing Eastern Tennessee and Southwest Virginia infrastructure? If you could like name some of those locations where some of these related facilities are. Oak Ridge, for instance, has already been named, right? And we've talked about Irwin and Jonesboro a bit.
Yeah, so there's a couple pieces of this. There's the BWXT piece, and then there's the broader nuclear piece. And I talked about the broader side with TVA and Oak Ridge / Y-12 outside of Knoxville. In terms of BWXT, big thing is that they have a de facto monopoly on naval reactors and naval fuel, which is to say, basically every modern U.S. submarine and aircraft carrier has a nuclear reactor that's its power source, and that reactor is almost certainly built by BWXT. And so this operation for the reactors is centered out of Ohio, Indiana, and Virginia. They have a facility near Akron, Ohio. They have a facility near Evansville, Indiana, in Mount Vernon, which is near the Illinois, Kentucky, Indiana tri-state area. And then they're headquartered in Lynchburg, Virginia. And so that's making reactor components and the fuel, and they do so-called advanced fuel development, lots of weird cutting edge fuels that are supposed to be inherently safe for small and modular reactors. And then Irwin, with their fuel fabrication, factors into that process also, both with if they start doing high purity uranium enrichment there, that is what you need to make that fuel. And then they also do fuel fabrication already. The one thing I was going to say also is that there's only two sites where private sector companies are authorized to handle high purity uranium, and they're both BWXT sites. It's the Irwin site and the Lynchburg site. And so part of why this high purity enrichment facility is being located there and why you have this whole cluster in the region is because there's tremendous security concerns around how you handle, transport, store, guard high purity uranium. And BWXT is the only company that has managed to obtain and hold those security certifications, which is also why I think it's important to oppose, because it's not something that's trivial to relocate elsewhere. It's one of only a handful of sites where it would make sense to add this kind of operation right now.
Okay. Yeah, maybe this is a good time to talk about, now that we've located some sites where the processing is happening for these various purposes, what are the dangers of to the local communities immediately in terms of having, I mean, if there's been a long history of places like Irwin and Oak Ridge, there's probably as much as the is allowed to be documented that falls outside of like national security, top secret, whatever. There's probably got to be some documentation of people who have been living in those communities in terms of the impact of either immediately working in those facilities and handling the materials or having them stored, moved around, you know, or just being in their communities. Can you talk about what those health concerns have been, the outcomes, what's understood?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to preface this by saying that this is a pretty difficult field of study. There is, as we would expect with this kind of thing, currently minimal available research. A lot of information has been repressed, and I personally am not a scientist. With that said, I'm going to do the best that I can. I'm going to focus on Irwin and areas specifically downstream of Irwin. So we know from the Irwin Citizens Awareness Network, ECAN in Irwin, that there is definitely some sense that something is very, very wrong. I don't know that this is really common knowledge, especially in the wider Tri-Cities area, but there also has been some citizen science research, and there are some reports, so the data that does exist is incredibly worrying. In 2010, Dr. Michael Ketterer started studying the pollution situation in and around Irwin, doing pro bono work for ECAN. He found highly enriched uranium in the Nolichucky Chucky River and the David Crockett Lake. And this is like coming from the NFS site. So the levels that were found in this 2010 report were significantly elevated above what we expect to occur naturally. They were not above what is like federally permitted for uranium and tap water, but they were violating the wastewater permit that the NFS site has. So since then, there has been more research. There has been uranium and plutonium found in soil, water. As recently as 2023, it was found in the dust in the attic of a Irwin resident, which also points to these compounds being released into the air. We know that this NFS site has been leaking into the water and into the air. So that is affecting counties downstream. It is also potentially affecting Asheville and other places within the airshed. So when we combine knowing that this plant is absolutely leaking with death rates, it becomes even more worrying. So there are two reports from the Radiation and Public Health Project. They have a bunch of numbers. I'm not going to read a bunch of numbers. I'm just going to give you one of them. From 2014 to 2018, in ages 0 to 74, the death rate for Unicoi County was 61.4% above the national average. And for Greene County, it was 50.6% above the national average. Now, death rates are high all kinds of places for all kinds of reasons. What is most damning here is the curve of the change in death rates over time. So both counties were actually close to the national average between, you know, the 70s and 80s, and they spiked in the 90s, and they have been climbing since. So this could absolutely be consistent with cumulative worsening effects over time that we expect from pollution like this. One other thing that I forgot to mention is that uranium is a heavy metal. Though like other heavy metals like lead, it bioaccumulates, it builds up in ecosystems. When it's being released into the water, it isn't just, you know, flowing downstream and being diluted, is being absorbed into the bodies of living things and that ecosystem, and then stored there in place and then released again when they die. So this obviously should be very, very worrying information. Clearly it's, you know, it's not conclusive, but it should 100% be a reason for a complete stop of nuclear activities in Irwin and significantly more research. Instead, BWXT, when they confront this information at all, they're saying that it's what they're doing is safe, it's fine, it poses no risk.
Which is probably why the CEO lives right next to the processing facility, right? Drinking the water right out of the pool and everything. Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
One thing I'll add is just that while you can say that the evidence is inconclusive, there's basically never conclusive evidence with this kind of radiation-based death, short of acute accidents and incidents. And even in the like highest level of recognized nuclear accidents, the like regulatory and institutional bureaucracy tends to deny effects with a kind of shocking gall. And so this is pretty good evidence. And one of the major things that ECAN, the Urban Citizen Awareness Network, is pushing for is a pause on active activities and new construction for an environmental impact study, which could look at cumulative impact, because lots of government reporting ignores cumulative impact, but everything we know about radiation and radiation-based increased mortality says that this is a linear relationship to exposure over time. And so there's every reason to think that there would be a slight time lag after operations started there, and then death rates climbing the way we've seen.
You also are possibly going to expect a geographical spread over time.
Okay.
And in terms of that geographical spread, I'll also say that, like, Knoxville is downriver from this. The Nolichucky flows into the French Broad, flows into the Tennessee, flows into the Mississippi. And while there's an amount of the pollution getting dispersed, also part of what that means is you're going to have random people who are probably dying as a result of this pollution, but in ways that statistically aren't going to show up, which is where I think there are lots of people in a broad region who have a stake in this and may just not know it or recognize it.
So, like, an easy example of that